For the first two talks on this video, we're going to tackle things in a rather different way. Instead of taking a book of the Bible, I want first of all to give you an overview of the whole Old Testament. Here we have a collection of books covering about 1,000 years, written by many different authors, and many different types of books. There are history books, law books, song books. How do they all relate together, all 39 of them? I think it's so important to have an overall picture of how these books fit together. God has not given us a topical Bible. Wouldn't it be nice if he had? You know, if the book of Genesis was all about God, and the book of Exodus all about Jesus, and the book of Leviticus all about the Holy Spirit, and if he'd put all the texts together under one topic, it would save us buying concordances and looking things up from all over. He deliberately didn't give us a Bible like that. He didn't want us to have a Bible like that. And so the teaching on any one topic is scattered over the whole Bible. And he didn't want to give us a box full of texts, though since chapter and verse numbers have been added to the Bible, that's how we treat it. And we pick a text out from here and a text out from there and just ignore the context so often. Well now, God has given us actually a library of books. The word Bible is a plural word. It comes from the Latin biblia and it means books. Not book. So the Bible is not a book, it's a library of books. And each book is a separate entity, and God wants you to learn his word book by book, because that's how he chose to give it to us. If he just wanted to give us a lot of texts, he'd have done that. If he wanted to give us a lot of topics, he'd have done that. But what he did do was give us these books, and every text, as we call each verse, is in a context of that book. And that book is in a context of history. God gave us his word in time and space. And it's very important to get both dimensions so that we understand at what time he said this and in what place he said this. And the time and place give it its meaning, because his word was given in life situations. He was always saying something to a particular situation in time and space. And those are the two contexts we need. So I thought in this talk I'd give you something of that context. Let's begin with space. And to do that, of course, we need maps. There is a geography of the Bible as well as a history of the Bible that we need to hold in our minds when we're reading it. And there are really only two maps that we need. A map of the whole Middle East and a map of the Promised Land in the Middle East. And we need to hold these, if we can, as a picture in our minds. Now, the familiar name that is given to the overall map of the Middle East is the Fertile Crescent. And that's a phrase you'll read in many books on Bible background. If you can see, I've drawn the crescent, a sort of new moon shape. I've drawn it on this map. And what it does is it links two very large rivers at each end, the River Nile and the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates. And those two major river basins produce fertility. So these are very fertile valleys, the Nile Delta and the Nile Valley, and then the Tigris and the Euphrates, what used to be called Mesopotamia, which means the middle of the rivers, Meso, middle, and Potamia rivers. So between the two rivers, a very fertile plain, very flat. Now then, these two fertile areas were the centers of power in the ancient world. These were the East and West world powers. So the whole Old Testament is a struggle between these two world powers, between Egypt and the different empires that arose here, notably Assyria and Babylon. That's where Saddam Hussein is now. That's where Iraq and Iran are now. Iran is here. Iraq is over here, but they are divided by this river. So we have two world powers in the ancient Middle East, and in between the Promised Land. Now you notice that the Arabian Desert covers all of this and the Sahara there. So when these two big powers attacked each other or tried to overcome each other, they had to travel through this narrow bit of land here. I don't know if you can see a rather purply patch here. That is actually black basalt rock which is very sharp and very hard. Even camels can't cross it. Which means that all the traffic was directed down this narrow coastal strip. If you didn't want to cross the desert, which most didn't, but if you wanted to keep feeding your troops, you had to go through the Fertile Crescent. You had to go round that crescent to the other end to attack your enemy. Which means that this was the crossroads of the world, actually. And somebody has said about Israel, if you will live in the middle of a crossroads, you're bound to get run over. Which is exactly what happened. They were constantly being run over. In Jesus' day, they were run over by the Romans. But before that, they'd been run over by the Greeks and the Syrians and the Egyptians. And so it goes on. And so here we have two world powers at either end of this crescent with a narrow corridor down the coast in between. And that is the narrow corridor. And God gave them a land at the crossroads of the world. Actually, the road from Europe comes to Arabia comes down through that corridor, and the road from Africa to Asia goes through that corridor. On this map, the road from Europe comes down the coast, it crosses the plain of Esdraelon, goes down into the Jordan Valley, and up onto the other side and down to Arabia. The road from Africa comes up the coastal plain, and it crosses over the same Vale of Esdraelon, or the Valley of Jezreel, and goes up through Capernaum and up through Damascus and on to India and China. So that the actual crossroads of the world is precisely there, at a little hill called Megiddo. And the hill of Megiddo in Hebrew is Harmageddon. And that's why most of the big battles in history took place there, at the crossroads of the world. Overlooking that crossroads is a little village called Nazareth. And a boy of Nazareth could watch the world go by. Literally, he could lie on the hill as a boy could Jesus. And it would like being in an airport lounge where you see all the nationalities coming and going. That's why they call this northern part Galilee of the Nations, because it was an international crossroads. Whereas further south up in the hills, it was very isolated and very Jewish. And Jerusalem is right up in them there hills, just about here. So you had two parts of the Promised Land, the international part, where all the nations came and went, and this very Jewish, isolated part up in the hills with Jerusalem. So you can see the importance of this land. God was going to plant his people at the crossroads of the world, where everybody could see them, where they could be a model of the kingdom of heaven on earth. So the whole world could see what blessing comes to people living under God's rule. But they would also see what curse comes of disobeying God's rule. So you can see why God chose this land. Now, it's a very fertile strip. Here's that black basalt. If you've ever been to Capernaum, you've seen the black basalt rock. They used it to build the houses of Capernaum. Terribly hard, sharp stuff. And so it was impassable. So there was this barrier of sand and basalt rock on the east and the barrier of the sea on the west. All the traffic went down the coast here and through this little break in the hills, which we call the Vale of Esdraelon or Harmageddon. Then we have this huge crack right down the earth's surface, right through to Africa. And here is its deepest point. The white bit is below sea level. And the Dead Sea is way below. You have the Jordan coming into this valley and going nowhere, just evaporating from the intense heat. So in this little area, the size of Wales, you have the entire world in miniature. You've got every kind of climate and every kind of scenery. You will find somewhere in Israel a place like home. In fact, the place most like England is just south of Tel Aviv down here. It's just like England. But they call Carmel Little Switzerland. And you can always go skiing at any time of year on the snow-capped Mount Hermon up here. And yet, 10 minutes later, you can be down among palm trees here. All the fauna and flora of Europe is to be found here. All the fauna and flora of Africa is to be found here. All the fauna and flora of Asia is to be found here. So you can have Scottish pine trees growing next to palm trees from the Sahara. And in the Bible days, all the wild animals were here. Lions, bears, crocodiles, camels. You've got the whole world squeezed into this little point where they all join. Fascinating. Oh, I could go on for hours, but I must stop. But once you've got a feel of the geography, and especially a feel for the shape of the land. Now, this is a relief map of the promised land. Can you see that deep valley running north-south? And a little bit of green on that side and a little bit of green on that side and then the desert. If you master that map and hold it in your mind, you will be able to read every Bible story that takes place in the promised land very easily. And you'll know why things happened as they did. And why Samaria was in the middle. And why Jesus' main ministry was up in Galilee. Why he was put to death by the Jews. That doesn't mean by all Israelis. It means the people of Judah. And when you read in the Gospel of John that the Jews killed Jesus, that doesn't mean all Israel. It means the southerners up in the hills. The Galileans were all for Jesus. It was the Jews, the Judeans, who were against him in the south. So, that's the geographical background to the Bible. In the Old Testament, we're moving around that fertile crescent from one end to the other. Sometimes the people of God are slaves in Egypt. Other times they're taken away into Assyria or Babylon at this end. But there they were right in the middle of it all, at the crossroads of the world. Now the other need dimension that you need to master is the dimension of time. And I've tried to reduce this dimension of time to a very simple pattern that's easily held in your mind. And at first sight that chart must look horrific to you. But as we go through it, I think you'll find it's actually very simple. Basically, the Old Testament covers 2,000 years of history, B.C., before Christ. But there is in Genesis 1 to 11 what we might call the prehistoric part. That means prehistoric to Israel. And so, in Genesis 1 to 11, we have the creation of the universe, the fall of man in the Garden of Eden, the flood, and the Tower of Babel. It's all about man generally. It's not about God's chosen people yet. It's about man, the human race. And that's the prehistoric history of Israel, before their history really began. But their history begins around the year 2000 BC. So just as far as we are after Christ, the history of Israel starts before Christ, 2,000 years either side. All right? That's our opening date for the history of Israel. And I divide it into four equal parts of 500 years each. And we take those four quarters as distinct periods. We mark each of the four dates, 2000, 1500, 1000, and 500 BC, with events and people. And I like to give names of people and events to these dates, so I fix them in my mind. And so, the first four words I've written down are events. Election, Exodus, Empire, Exile. And you've got the four events that mark the four quarters of their history. That's when God chose Abraham and elected Abraham and his descendants to be his people. That's when Moses led them out of Egypt. That's when they had all the land God promised to them and had a time of unparalleled prosperity and peace. And I've called it the empire because they not only had their own land, but many other nations were now under their control. And then the lowest point of their history, exile. And roughly speaking, those four events fit those four dates. Then I attach a prominent person to each of those dates. Abraham is the man to attach to 2000, Moses to 1500 or thereabouts, David to 1000, he was reigning in the year 1000 BC, and Isaiah is the most prominent man associated with the exile. So you've got four events and four people. But also, the leadership of Israel changed. And the leadership in each of these four periods was different. In the first period, they were led by patriarchs. That's a word for forefathers, really, patriarchs. From Abraham to Joseph. In the second period, they were led by prophets. From Moses to Samuel. In the third 500 years, they were led by princes, from Saul to Zedekiah. And in the fourth period, they were led by priests, from Joshua who came with Zerubbabel back from the exile, right through to Caiaphas in our Lord's day. So you can see that the leadership changed from patriarchs to prophets to princes and then to priests. Now, it doesn't mean there weren't prophets at other times or priests at other times, but the leadership of the nation passed from one group to the other until Jesus came, who was prophet, priest, and king, all rolled into one. So they tried three different kinds of leadership in their history, but they were really looking for someone who could combine all these things in one. And all the leadership failed in the Old Testament. So have you got those four basic periods in your mind? Now, once you've got that, the next thing is to put in two gaps, each of them 400 years. The first gap is here, and the second gap is here. And during those 400 years, on both occasions, God said nothing and he did nothing. So there is nothing in your Bible from those two periods. Now, of course, there are books written in those two periods, but they're not in our Bible, because they do not cover the time when God was saying and doing things. You see, when we read this phrase in the Bible, the living God, do you realize what that means? Well, did you realize a few years ago what it meant when some theologians started saying God is dead? You heard that phrase. Well, do you realize what they meant? They did not mean that God has ceased to exist. That was a popular misunderstanding. What they meant was, God is no longer active in this world. He still exists, but he's somewhere else now. As you know, my wife and I lost our daughter last July. She was 36. She's dead. But that doesn't mean she's ceased to exist. She's alive, she's conscious, she's communicating, though she can't communicate with us now. But she's not living now. By that we mean she's not speaking and acting in this world as she was. But she's fully conscious and communicating elsewhere. And she's with the Lord. You see, so she's alive. But she's not living in this world. As far as this world goes, she's dead. Now that's what the living God means. And during these two periods, God was dead, if you like. See, he was not acting in this world. He was out of touch. And so the books written in these periods, the books written in this gap were the Apocrypha. And you won't find them in our Bibles. The Catholics put them in their Bibles because they find prayers to the saints and purgatory in the Apocrypha. That's why they put it in. But in fact, doesn't belong to the Bible, because those books were written in a day when God was not living. But in these periods, he was the living God. He was speaking and acting in our world. Now, once you've got those two gaps, that gap occurred in the first quarter and this gap occurred in the last quarter. And that's why Malachi is the last book in your Bible, though there's a 400-year gap before Matthew comes along. Because God wasn't saying anything, he wasn't doing anything. So we're not interested in the history. It's just like any other history then. And similarly here, we've got nothing between Genesis and Exodus, though there's a 400-year gap there. And we often miss that when we read straight on. But Exodus makes it clear there's a 400-year gap. It's interesting what happened during the gap. In the gaps when God was silent and inactive, the Egyptian, the Indian, and the Chinese culture developed in that gap. And in this gap, you had people like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and the Greek philosophy that's influenced the Western world so much. You had Buddha, Confucius, and then you had people like Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar. See, when God isn't busy, man is. And that's when so much has happened in man's history that's really not of relevance to God, because it's what God's history contains that is of importance to us. Now then, let's look at some details. Genesis 12 to 50 picks up the first period of Israel's history when they were led by patriarchs. And it's possible that the book of Job comes in there as well. Everything in Job is very much the sort of life that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob lived, the life of the traveling people of those days. Then we come to the next quarter, and again, we only have a few books from that quarter, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, or from Moses' lifetime. And then Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, continuing the history of that period. Then we have the empire days, and we have more books. We have the history of the third quarter of their history in Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. But we also have some poetic books. David and the Book of Psalms, Solomon and Song of Solomon, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. But after Solomon, there was civil war, and the 12 tribes divided into two. 10 in the north called themselves Israel, 2 in the south called themselves Judah. And from then on, they didn't have a united nation. There were prophets during that time, Elijah and Elisha, but they didn't write down for subsequent generations what they prophesied. So we don't have books called by them. Then suddenly, we have a flood of books, all prophets, and all associated with the exile. And that's when the main books of prophecy are written. And some of them prophesied before the exile, some of them during the exile, and some after the exile, which tells us how important this event was in their history, the loss of the land God had promised them. These prophets warned them they were going to lose the land. These prophets comforted them when they did lose the land. And these prophets were concerned with rebuilding the land when they came back after 70 years away. We have one or two history books from this period. Daniel and Esther were both about the Jews away from the land when they were in Babylon. Ezra and Nehemiah, which we're going to discuss later, they were the two men who helped to rebuild Jerusalem and get the people established back in their own land again. Well, now, does that give you a feel of the Old Testament? Unfortunately, you see, the books of the Old Testament are not always in chronological order, especially the prophets. The history books seem to be, but when you get to the prophets, they simply put the big ones first and the little ones second, which is terribly confusing. And what I'm saying is that of each of the prophet books, you need to ask, was this written before the exile, during the exile, or after the exile? And that will give you a clue to the understanding. Now, I hope all is crystal clear. But if you can memorize the basic features of that with its 2,000 years of history divided into 500 years each, then you'll get a really good grasp, and then you fit the books in. And of course, there are different types of books. There's the law, the first five books, and you see where they fit in. Genesis before the gap and the other four after the gap. Then there are history books, you see where they fit in. Then there are writings, mainly poetry books, and you see that they come out of the period when they were most prosperous. That's when culture and art prosper. See, when the nation is rich and at peace, that's when things like poetry get written. It's a luxury, is art and culture, and you see it flourishing at the peak. Now, there's one more thing on this chart, which I'm sure you've noticed, and that is this green dotted line. You see, the peak of their fortunes was the empire under David. Everything leads up to that, and then everything goes downhill from then on until they lose the land. It's a tragic story, really, but that is why every Jew looks back to that period and longs for it to come back. That was the golden age. Lord, send us another David. Send us a Messiah like David. Send us the Son of David. And still to this day, the Jewish people are looking for that Son of David to come back and restore the prosperity. The last question the disciples asked Jesus before he ascended to heaven, when are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel? And still they're asking 2,000 years later. So that's the peak. And their fortunes, on the whole, were up and up and up to that point. But from then, down and down. Civil war, division between the 10 tribes, the north and two in the south. It's all in the Book of Kings, which is a very sad and sordid tale when you read it through. And of all the kings they had, most of them were bad. Many were assassinated. They had one dreadful queen, which we're going to talk about later. Just one, because it was God's will they should only have kings. And they had one dreadful queen. But we'll talk about that on another occasion. Well, now there it is. And then after this 400-year gap, during which they had no words from God and didn't see a single miracle, then suddenly it all started again. John the Baptist came preaching, the first prophet for a long time. And then the miracles came with Jesus. And the birth, death, resurrection, ascension of Jesus starts our New Testament, which only covers 100 years or less. So your whole New Testament was written in 100 years, whereas the Old Testament was written over 2,000. And if you go back to creation, how long? Now, that is the chart that I hold in my mind. And by the way, a friend of mine called Professor Lagarde Smith, who is the professor of law in the Pepperdine University in Malibu, and my wife was Pepperdine before I changed the name, he has produced a Bible, quite unique, New International Version, no chapter and verse numbers. Did I hear a hallelujah? No? No chapter and verse numbers. And the Bible is in chronological order, so that you get to the prophets at the right time and you read the story in the order in which God spoke and acted. And it's quite a book. The only divisions in it are there's a star in the margin every so often, and altogether there are 365 stars in the margin. Guess why? It means you can read the whole story of God in a year. It's about 5 pages each day. And you will get the Word of God in its proper context of time and place, with some very helpful little notes of introduction. It really is a fascinating production, and it's now available. I'm not, I don't have a commission on selling it, but there it is. He is a friend. Well, now, that's perhaps put us into the history side, and we've looked at the geography side, but let's now look at one other complication. And that is, there is a big difference between our English Bible and the Hebrew Bible. A very big difference. And I'm afraid those who arranged our English Bible didn't do us a very great service. Because we have therefore tended to think of books rather differently to the way the Jew thinks of the scriptures in the Old Testament. We tend in English to divide the books between 3 categories. And I partly did that on the previous chart. We tend to think of the history books, and all the history books are put together in English from Genesis through to Esther. And they are all at the beginning of our Old Testament. And they are in chronological order. And that's helpful to get the history line. But it's not helpful from another point of view. The next group of books in our Bibles are poetry. Book of Job, which is all poetry, Psalms, Proverbs, poetry, Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon. So the poetry books have been pushed together as the second grouping. Now, even though they're in groups, it's very rare for an English Bible to have a heading history or poetry. So the books just run on one after another, and we tend not to realize we've moved into a different group of books. And then all the prophetic books are listed, and they are divided between the major and the minor. I'm sure you've heard those words, major prophets, minor prophets. All it means is they're big ones and they're little ones. Not people or in message, but just how much they spoke or how much we have of their message. We have a lot of Isaiah, a lot of Jeremiah, a lot of Ezekiel, but very little of Joel or Obadiah. So they're called major, the big books, and minor, the 12 smaller books. And that's how the English Old Testament is arranged. And frankly, it is not very helpful. Pity, but there it is. When you read the Hebrew scriptures, they have 3 very clear divisions, very different from one another. The first 5 books are not regarded as history at all, but as law. And I've already explained that. And therefore, they're not called Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. They are given the titles of the first words on the scroll as you unroll it, so that you recognize it straight away to read it. And these books were read, and still are, every year in the synagogue, right through on a lectionary. Then the big surprise comes that the next group are called the prophets. And they put into the prophets what we call history. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, we call history. But they call them the former prophets. And then they call these that we have here the latter prophets. Now, why should they call those book prophets? Well, of course, there are prophets in them. Joshua was a prophet. Samuel was a prophet. That's not the reason why. The reason is that this is prophetic history. And prophetic history is quite different from other history. And I need to explain why. All history is based on two principles. Selection is the first, and connection is the second. And when anybody writes a history book, the first thing they must do is select what they're going to put in and what they're going to leave out. Nobody can write a complete history about anybody or anything. In fact, John's Gospel says if everything Jesus did and said was written down, the world couldn't hold the books. So every bit of history is a selection of some events. And every historian selects what he thinks is important. And the second principle is the principle of connection. Having selected the important events, the historian then tries to show the connection between those events. That this led to that, and that led to the other. Do you follow me? And all history books are based on those two principles. What to select, and how to connect. Now, prophetic history has its own answer to those two principles. Prophetic history only selects what is important to God. That's why there's nothing about Buddha or Confucius in the Bible. It only selects what is important to God, and then it connects up what happens to people with God. And that's the connection. And therefore, these books are written from a prophetic point of view. They only select what is important to God, and they connect everything with God. And that's why they're called by the Jews former prophets. And you notice the book of Ruth is not there. And the books of Chronicles are not there. Because neither Ruth nor Chronicles are prophetic history. Certainly the story of Ruth came where the English Bible puts it, between Judges and Samuel. That's where it happened. But if you read the story of Ruth, God says nothing in it, and he does nothing in it. Have you noticed? It's a lovely story. And it's the story of David's ancestor, but there's not a single thus saith the Lord in the book of Ruth. And Chronicles also, though it sounds like Kings, when you study it carefully, it's quite different from the book of Kings, and it's not a prophetic book. It's written from an entirely different point of view. So, they have the former and the latter prophets, and then they put everything else in the writings. That's where they put Chronicles, though they call it the words of the days. That's where they put Ruth. They also put the poetry books. They put Ecclesiastes, though they call it the preacher. And Lamentations is just called How. How. That's the first word of the book, actually. And Esther is there. Even Daniel. Daniel isn't among the prophets. He's down here. There's a reason for all that. Now, it's interesting that on the road to Emmaus and during his resurrection, Jesus did Bible studies. He never did that during his life. But after he rose from the dead, he gave Bible studies for the first time. And it says he took them through the law, the prophets, and the writings, and showed them everything concerning himself. So for Jesus, that was the Old Testament. And I personally believe it should be that for us as well. Because it helps us to realize that it's not straight history. It is prophetic history. And it has therefore a message for us. The books of the Apocrypha are history books. And for example, there's a fascinating little bit of Hebrew history or Israeli history in the days of the Maccabees, when they rebelled against the Greeks who were occupying the land. And it's been made into oratorios, hasn't it? Maccabees. And it's very moving history. But it's only history. You can read it if you're interested. But it will not speak to you from God, because it's not prophetic. And prophetic history speaks to us today. And that's why God was able to speak to you yesterday, through the books of the Old Testament. God was speaking to you. But if I was teaching you the book of the Maccabees, that would not happen. It would be interesting, but that's all. So can you see the importance of seeing this not as history at all, but as seeing it as God's law and God's prophecy, and seeing these as a kind of miscellaneous thing? Then what was the principle behind the selection of these? Why didn't they put the Apocrypha in here? The answer is that all these books were written during the period when God was living. Meaning by that, when God was active in this world. And so all these books came out of that same prophetic period, that same time when God was busy. None of these books were written in the gaps. And so we've got in our Bible the law of God, the prophetic history, and also all the other books that came out of the period when God was busy with his people. Now, can you see the shape of the Old Testament? I think it'd be helpful if our Old Testament reverted to this, because then we'd get the message more clearly. But it's not too bad like this. But now we can see how it all fits in. And just let me remind you of a chart that we used when we looked at Genesis. The first five books of the Bible are very special. They are basic to the whole Bible. They are the law of Moses, the five books of Moses, the Torah. And there's a very interesting pattern. What did you use to call those things that you did with a string shaped like that? Sorry? Not a yo-yo. Diabolo, that's it. Well, keep the diabolo shape in your mind when you look at the first five books of the Bible. Genesis, which means beginnings. Exodus means going out. Leviticus, as it says, is about the Levites. Numbers is self-explanatory. Deutero means second, and nomos means law, second law. The Ten Commandments were given here and here a second time. But look at this amazing pattern. Take who? Genesis is concerned with the whole human race. Exodus is the beginning of their national life. Leviticus is concerned with one tribe, the Levites. Numbers is concerned with national life. And Deuteronomy looks again to the history of the whole world. So you've got a kind of diabolo shape. Then look at the places. It starts in Chaldea, Canaan, then Egypt, then at Sinai, then through the Negev and Edom, Moab, and back into the Promised Land. Look at when. Genesis covers centuries. Exodus only covers years, 300. Leviticus covers only 1 month. Numbers covers years again, and Deuteronomy covers centuries again. It's an amazing pattern when you see it, all put beautifully together. But those five books are, in a sense, the most important part of the Old Testament. And the more you know about them, the more you'll understand the rest of the Old Testament and indeed the New. So the Jews are right to put a special emphasis on these five books. They are the foundation of the Bible, and particularly the book of Genesis, to which we're going to devote a whole video. I want to talk to you now about Hebrew poetry. Fortunately, most of our modern Bibles print poetry as poetry and prose as prose, and it's very important that they do. For example, prose is printed like a newspaper column with no gaps between the sentences, and every bit of space is filled, and the unit is the paragraph. So that's prose, but poetry has lots more space in it, much shorter lines, and is set out in verses. And the basic unit is the verse and not the paragraph. Now, why should that be important? Prose and poetry. And why is it important to have a Bible that shows you the difference? Because English poetry is a little different from Hebrew poetry, so it doesn't always appear as clear to us as it should. When God speaks in prose, he is communicating thoughts from his mind to your mind. But when he speaks in poetry, he is communicating his feelings from his heart to your heart. So that should be a real key to unlock the Bible for you. When you read poetry in the Bible, you should be asking about the feelings of God. And there's a tremendous lot in the Bible about God's emotions. God is a very feeling person. And we affect his feelings every day. This day we may make him sad or happy or angry. So that we are affecting God's feelings constantly. And in fact, what we feel about God is not nearly so important as what he feels about us. So it's important to study poetry and prose. And I'm going to speak about poetry now, because in the next talk we're going to look at the Psalms, and after that Job, so we need to understand a bit of poetry in Hebrew thinking before we go any further. Most of the prophets write in poetry, spoke in poetry, which means that they were really speaking from the heart of God about how God was feeling. And that's very important. You see, you can be too intellectual in your study of the Bible. You can just get nice thoughts from it. But you need to feel God's feelings as well as think his thoughts. And the Bible communicates his feelings in poetry. Now, prose is a more normal, natural form of speech. When we talk to each other, we use prose. It'd be rather odd if we use poetry. It's, in a sense, artificial. It has to be composed. You have to think about what you're going to say before you say it with poetry, whereas prose you can just get straight into. For example, supposing I came home and said to Enid here, "I'm ready for my supper, wife. Oh, good, it's pies and peas. You've given me a dirty knife. I'd like a clean one, please." "And since there is no second course, I'll have some more tomato sauce." Now, that is not the way I talk when I come in, you see. If I talk like that, it means I've done a lot of thinking about it before I come in. It is an artificial form of speech. It is not normal speech. It's special speech. Then why use it? Why bother to compose poetry? Well, the answer is, it has a much deeper appeal to people, and therefore is likely to have a greater influence on them. It reaches the parts that prose can't reach. See? And that's why you find poetry in greeting cards, in Valentine cards, in birthday cards, in Christmas cards, because they're a heart message. And so we say it in poetry rather than prose, beginning to get a feel. That's a good phrase to use, actually, to get a feel for poetry. First of all, poetry goes deeper into the mind. It stays in the memory much longer. It's much easier to remember poems from your school days than the prose that you were taught in, isn't it? You can recite poetry you learned as a child. It stays in the mind. Most of us learn our theology from hymns, songs. Why? Because it's poetry. And that's why it's so important that you have songs with content. And some of the songs today have little content. But if you really soak yourself in the didactic hymns of Charles Wesley, you're really going to have a lot of knowledge. But they're much easier to remember. So they go deeper into the mind, into the intuitive and artistic hemisphere of your brain, which holds on to things better. And the second thing is they go deeper into the heart. They touch your feelings. Let me touch your feelings with a little poem. "They walked down the lane together. The sky was full of stars. Together they reached the farmyard gate. He lifted for her the bars. She neither smiled nor thanked him. Indeed, she knew not how, for he was just a farmer's boy, and she was a Jersey cow." Now, see? Now, that poem touched two feelings in you. It touched your romantic feelings, and your heart maybe began to beat a bit quicker, wondering what was coming. And then when it came, it touched your sense of humor and your fun. You see, now prose, if I'd said that in prose, wouldn't have had nearly the same effect. And then poetry, it goes deeper into the will. It can challenge you at a deeper level than prose to change your way of life. And one of the poems that I've quoted many times when I've preached was written by the famous army chaplain of the First World War, Studdard Kennedy, who became known as Woodbine Willie because he gave out cheap Woodbine cigarettes to the soldiers, and then became a vicar in Shrewsbury, a church that's now Pentecostal Assembly, but I've preached in it and I thought of him. And his wonderful poem is called Indifference. Now listen to this poem for reaching, bringing a challenge to your will.
When Jesus came to Golgotha, they hanged him on a tree. They drove great nails through hands and feet and made a Calvary. They crowned him with a crown of thorns. Red were his wounds and deep. For those were crude and cruel days, and human flesh was cheap. When Jesus came to Birmingham, they simply passed him by. They never hurt a hair of him. They only let him die. For men had grown more tender, and they would not give him pain. They only passed him down the street and left him in the rain. Still Jesus cried, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." And still it rained the wintry rain that drenched him through and through. The crowds went home and left the streets without a soul to see that Jesus crouched against a wall and cried for Calvary. See, that poem really gets you. So that's why the Hebrews use poetry. It can touch the whole person, heart, mind, and will. And therefore, God has used it a great deal. Now, the key to poetry is to make words beautiful as well as meaningful. That's what draws us to poetry. The words are arranged in such a way that they appeal to our sense of beauty, which is basically a sense of balance, of symmetry, of proportion. A beautiful person has well-balanced features. And it is this symmetry, this balance, that appeals to us in poetry. There's a beautiful balance about the words. The lines are the same length. Now, there are three types or three basic features of poetry which makes the word beautiful for us. First of all, there is rhyme. Rhyme. That's a big feature of English poetry, but not of Hebrew poetry. But rhyme is very popular with us. The balance of rhyming words. Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after. There's rhyming all the way through, and most nursery rhymes are built on rhyme for their appeal. John Betjeman was mainly building on rhyme in his poems. Now we have blank verse. I never know whether it's poetry or not, but if the words are arranged beautifully, it is, but it certainly doesn't depend on rhyme. And nowadays, the shock line has value. 30 days hath September, April, June, and November, all the rest have 31, is that fair? And a line comes in which startles you and breaks the rhythm and brings you up with a jerk. And therefore, all poetry depends on the irregularity as well as the regularity. The second major feature is rhythm. The beat also makes speech beautiful. We call it the meter, based on syllables. The limerick is classic case, and it follows the same rhythm. A limerick always follows the same rhythm. Now, this is true of Hebrew poetry. A favorite rhythm in English poetry is what we call the 4-3 rhythm. The boy stood on the burning deck whence all but he had fled. The boy stood on the burning deck whence all but he had fled. That's 4-3 beat. And that's very common in Hebrew poetry too. It's common in the metrical psalms in Scotland. The Lord's my shepherd, I'll not want. 4. He makes me down to lie. 3. In pastures green he leadeth me, 4. The quiet waters by, 3. 4-3, 4-3. Got it? And somehow that sticks in our mind. It's a rhythm that fixes the words for us. So that's the second thing. Now, with rhythm, it's terribly important that the emphasis falls on the right syllable. And again, I have to say, a lot of choruses today, the beat is on the wrong syllable every time. If I give you just one. For all the good our Father does, God and King of us all. Now, doesn't that jar? Because the beat comes on the and instead of God. And that's one of the differences between good and bad choruses and good and bad poetry. And if the beat is not on the right word, it doesn't reach us. And you find in Hebrew poetry the rhythm is on the right word. But, of course, that's in Hebrew. Not so easy to put into English. The other thing that enhances poetry is repetition. So we have rhyming, rhythm, and repetition. And the repetition of a word or a line makes it poetic. And Brutus is an honorable man. Do you know that speech? And Brutus is an honorable man. And Brutus is an honorable man. And somehow the repetition becomes poetic to us. Or, bah, bah, black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, yes, sir. Repetition of a word. And it becomes a balance. We've got two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, two arms, two legs. And so a double repetition of a word becomes poetic. It becomes balanced and symmetry to us. So especially twice repetition. So pleasant sounds are a key, and poetry is meant to be read aloud. You don't really get poetry if you just read it with your eyes. Which means that if you're going to use the Psalms, for example, read them aloud. You're far more likely to get something from reading the poetry of the Bible aloud than just reading it silently. There's something very satisfying about the sound of poetry. It depends on sound. The content is nicely packaged. And poetry brings wonder into things. There's a sense of wonder in poetry that there isn't in prose. And wonder is halfway to worship. That's why the Psalms are all in poetry. I've got some versions here of a nursery rhyme. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are, up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky. Now you can kill that childlike wonder in that poem by reducing it to scientific terms. Here's another version I came across. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, I don't wonder what you are. You're the cooling down of gases forming into solid masses. Now, do you notice the childlike wonder has gone? Let's take it a step further. Scintillate, scintillate, globule prolific. Fair would I fathom thy nature specific. Loftily poised in ether capacious, closely resembling a gem carbonaceous. It's the same poem, but it's killed dead. It's gone scientific. And in a sense, prose is scientific language of the mind, but poetry is wonder language of the heart. There's a childlike quality about it. Well, now, all that's about poetry generally. And one other feature of poetry, and that is that poetry is visual as well as verbal. It constantly paints pictures in the mind that you can see. Images, imagination is very necessary to writing poetry. And it uses lots of metaphors, lots of similes, lots of images. That twinkle, twinkle, little star, like a diamond in the sky. That's a picture. You can see the diamond. Or in the Psalms, as the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul longs for God. There's a picture there of an animal with its tongue hanging out, panting. As a deer pants, so my soul longs for God. Now, so far we've been considering English poetry, which is based on Greek and Roman, where the emphasis is on the sound. But in Hebrew poetry, that is not the case. The emphasis is on the sense. And that is because if you're not careful, the sound can override the sense. And you can appreciate the sound of poetry and get no message from it. You follow me? That, of course, is why the English are known for nonsense verse. Edward Lear and Lewis Carroll were masters of it. You know the Jabberwocky? Listen to the beat of this. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outrabe. Do you get it? Beautiful poetry. I mean, it's wonderful poetry to read. It's fascinating. But the message? What message? You see? It's wasted. Now, that is why Hebrew poetry put the emphasis not on the sound of the words, but on the sense of the words. And therefore we look always for the sense. That's why there is very little rhyme in Hebrew poetry. There is some rhythm, especially the 4-3 and the 3-3, but mostly it is based on repetition. And that is the key to Hebrew poetry. It is in fact repetition. We therefore call it parallelism. And it's based on the two-fold repetition. I've said we have two eyes, two arms, two legs. Two of a thing, give it balance. And therefore, Most Hebrew poetry is in what we call couplet form, two statements that belong together. And these two statements are related in different ways to give us a bit of variety. Sometimes the second statement is the same all the way through the psalm. A statement is made and then, for his mercy endures forever. Another statement, for his mercy endures forever. So that's one very simple form of Hebrew poetry, to have a refrain as the second half of each couplet. Got it? We may use one a bit later and shout it. It really is effective, because a couplet enables you to have what we call antiphonal singing, which means two choirs singing against each other, or to each other. And so one choir sings the first sentence and the other choir echoes it with the other sentence. And there's an echo. And the psalms are very meaningful if you read or sing them antiphonally like that. And one half sings or reads or says the first line and the other the second. You try it sometime. You see, in the New Testament, they use psalms in worship. And we should. Again, unfortunately, modern choruses usually contain no more than one or two verses of a psalm and therefore miss the context. And it's so important to take the psalm as a whole. So encourage your church to use psalms as a whole. And if you can't sing them, then say them. But read them like this as a couplet, one voice and then another. Now, the three ways in which they are related to each other I've put here. This parallelism, it's an echo. Take a typical verse. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? That is Hebrew poetry. It's the same thing said twice. You got it? So just let's split right down the middle, and then you say, where can I go from your spirit? And then you respond with, where can I flee from your presence? And you'll get the idea. All right?
Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?
Did you hear the echo? You see, it's an echo. All the time. And the second line echoes the first and gives a beautiful balance and symmetry to what's being said. And having said it twice, of course, it sticks in your mind. And the thought is there twice. When I'm preaching in another language, I have to do it through what we call an interrupter who steals half my time. But those who know English, of course, get the message twice. And they really get so much from it, because they hear each sentence first in English from me and then in the language from the interpreter. They get far more than the others who only know one language. So this repetition is very good for emphasis, saying a thing twice. It's very good for response, this echo, and it's very good for balance. But it's not just simple repetition. The second line usually takes the thought of the first line a step further. With me? And it does that in a number of ways. Let's take an example from Psalm 6. O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger or discipline me in your wrath. Now you see, rebuking is just being told, but discipline is being punished. So the second line has taken the same thought a little further. You with me? Don't rebuke me, and then don't discipline me. And yet they belong together. They're poetic. Or take the next verse. Be merciful to me, O Lord, for I am faint. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are in agony. See? Now, at first line, he's just feeling faint. But in the second line, he's in agony and needing healing. So once again, the second line has taken the first line a little further. Now, I hope all this isn't destroying poetry for you, because really, analyzing poetry is like taking a flower to pieces and pulling the petals off and looking at the stamen and so on, and it destroys it. Poetry needs to be experienced in its beauty. But I want to help you to understand what's going on when you read a psalm, why it was written and how it was written. Now, there are three major types of couplet. What we call synonymous, in which the same thought is said in different words. That's what we've been talking about so far. Then there is antithetic, in which the second line, as it were, contradicts, or rather presents a contrast to the first line. And the balance is by way of contrast. So, for example, those who sow in tears will reap with songs of joy. Now, do you see the contrast? Sowing and reaping, tears, joy. So now the couplet has a contrast built in. That's what we call antithetic couplets. It is the opposite thought. So synonymous is the same thought, but in different words. It may be just simply repeated, like the first I gave you, or it may take it further, as we looked at. But both of those are really the same thought expressed differently. But now we have opposite thought expressed together. He who goes out reaping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with him. Now that's taken these two lines much further. For now we have reaping and sheaves, and we have sowing and seed, and going out and returning. And then we have what we call synthetic couplets. And synthetic couplets add to the first thought. They don't repeat it, and they don't contrast it, but they add much more to it. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Now the second is the result of the first. The first is the cause, the second is the effect. And the 23rd Psalm is built on that pattern, what we call the synthetic. He makes me lie down in green pastures. That thought is not repeated, but he leads me beside still waters. And how meaningful those two last lines become when you study shepherding in the Middle East. You see, there isn't green grass everywhere. You can't just put sheep into a field and let them graze. You have to go up to 15 miles a day to find some green grass growing. And a good shepherd knows where the green pastures are. But furthermore, a sheep's nostrils are next door to its mouth, much closer their mouth than ours noses to the mouth. The result is they can't drink unless the water is still. If they try and drink in troubled or running water, they will drown. They'll sniff water up into their nostrils. So the shepherd has to know where there's green pasture and where there's still water. But those two things together create a picture of a shepherd who really knows his job and is able to do this for the sheep. You follow? Now that's synthetic poetry. So we've got these three forms of poetry, but many, many varieties within these forms. And you'll find that these patterns are constantly broken by irregularities just to keep the interest and to make it sparkle a bit. So sometimes the rhythm is broken and sometimes the pattern is broken. Sometimes instead of two lines, there are three lines together. Let's just look at some of them. For example, here are three lines from Psalm 29. Ascribe to the Lord, O mighty ones. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due to his name. Now there's a three, a tricolon we call it. And so it's built up a crescendo. Ascribe to the Lord is the refrain, and then different words are added in three lines. Or here's another. From Psalm 3, O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? How many are saying of me, God will not deliver him? Now you've got the repetition, how many, how many, how many. But the wording is different and each sentence builds on the previous one. Then sometimes there's an omission and a word is not included or a phrase drops out. Full of pictures, as the heart pants, I've told you that one, as a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him. There's a picture of a tender father with his children. Then sometimes the lines cross over, and the first part of the first line becomes the second part of the second line. Let's take an example. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. And the way has swapped places. Got it? Well, now all this, it's just to help you to appreciate the Hebrew poetry much more. There is sometimes a kind of staircase in it. It kind of climbs up. For example, here's a little staircase verse. The voice of Yahweh breaks the cedars. Yahweh breaks the cedars of Lebanon. So that there's an introduction of something new in that second line, namely cedars of Lebanon. Sometimes the poetry is based on the alphabet. I'm trying to think of that pop song years ago. A, you're adorable. B, you're so beautiful. C, you're a cutie in my charms. No, I better stop. I'm looking at it. Now, that is an acrostic poem, and it's based on the alphabet. And many, many psalms are based on the alphabet. The first verse is Aleph, which is A in Hebrew, and second verse, third verse. Psalm 119, that's a very long one. It goes on and on and on. And each section of that psalm, every verse in that section begins with a new letter of the alphabet, all the way through. Now, it's artificial. And some people say, well, I think we should be natural when we speak to God. I don't think we should be artificial. We should be spontaneous. We should just say what comes into our heads. Well, if you do that, you will only use prose to address God. See? But I think we should use poetry as well, because that makes you think what you want to say. You have to prepare what you want to say. And that's how most choruses and hymns get written. Somebody sits down and says, what do I want to say to God? And they think about it and they prepare. And we use artificial speech whenever we sing a hymn together. But it enables us to sing it together. If I just said, now the next time of worship, each of you sing whatever you really want to say to God, we're going to have chaos. It then becomes individual worship, not corporate worship. And so the advantage of using poetry in worship is that we can say it together. There used to be a family tradition in our house. Our three children used to come and wake me up at an ungodly hour on a certain day in the year. And then they stood in a row at the foot of my bed, three of them. And then in a most artificial way, they addressed me in poetry. And after they'd done that, they then gave me a bag of their favorite sweets. Now, this happened once a year. And they stood there and sang, happy birthday to you. See? Now, in a sense, that was artificial, the three of them standing in a row and all saying the same thing. Wouldn't it have been nicer if each of them had come separately and told me what they really felt and said, Daddy, I love you? Wouldn't that be nice? No. Because they would then not be my family. Do you understand what I'm saying? The fact that they would come together and sing together meant more to me because of their relationship with each other. Do you see what I'm getting at? It pleases the Lord when we say something together. But of course we have to use artificial speech. We have to use words that somebody else has written. But God loves to see us together. Okay, standing in a row and singing to God. But we're nevertheless expressing God. We're coming together to do this. And poetry enables us to do that. So I'm glad it's in poetry. And of course, Hebrew poetry is easier to use in other languages. It's easier to translate. Poems that depend on rhyme are very difficult to take into another language, because the words in another language will not rhyme. I've tried. And I like quoting a poem when I preach, and when I've got an interpreter, it kills it dead. You know, and it just doesn't come across. So the big advantage of Hebrew poetry is that it can be so translated. And even in English, the poetry comes across. The balance of the couplets come across. Well, do you think poetry touches God's heart as well as ours? I believe it does. And I believe King David knew that. And the prophets knew that they could reach human hearts better with poetry than prose. And I think that's why they used it. Which means they must really have thought about what they wanted to say. And thought in God's presence and let the Holy Spirit put what they wanted to say into poetry, so that they could say it in a way that people couldn't forget. But I believe it touches God's heart as well, and that he likes poetry. There's so many things in God that appear in us. You know that God laughs, don't you? Well, Psalm 2 tells us that, so we can laugh. You know that God walks, so walking is the healthiest exercise we can take. You know that God sings. We're going to be looking at the prophet Zephaniah shortly. And Zephaniah is the prophet who tells us that God bursts into song over us and rejoices over us with singing. And that's why we sing. You know that God whistles, don't you? Do you? How many have read that in the Bible? Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Just 6? You are reading your Bibles, aren't you? Go and read the first few chapters of Isaiah if you don't believe me. You say, what translation is that? Any translation. God whistles, so we can whistle. And maybe in a moment we'll do just that. If you can be ready to give us a note, Max. But we can whistle. And we can whistle for God. But I believe poetry touches his heart. Because it means that somebody's given a bit of thought to what they want to say. Somebody's really given a bit of time. How can I best address this to God? And somebody's produced a chorus or a hymn. That's beautiful. Later we're going to be singing a hymn that I've composed. But let's sing right now, Majesty, Worship His Majesty. But I'm going to ask all the men to whistle and all the ladies to sing. And if you're a man who can't whistle, then you can sing, but you're going to be very conspicuous. And if there are ladies here who can whistle, I'm not going to forbid you to whistle. But it works best if the men whistle and the ladies sing. And we don't need the piano, we just need a note. Just one note, because the whistling, we've got about 50 or 60 wind instruments here. And we're going to do it, all right? Right, okay, got the note? Let's just try it. We're going to whistle and sing to the Lord. That sounded beautiful from up here. You go and suggest that your church does that. They'll be horrified. But that's the last thing I want to say about poetry, and that is that it can be set to music. And music is very near to the heart of God. He is musical. And because musical is mathematical as well. And he's made us musical. And because of the poetry in the Bible, we can sing our prayers and our praises to God. Even when we're really down in the dumps and feeling in despair, there's a song in the Bible that you can sing. So you can still sing, whether you're up or down, whatever your condition. We're going to see that in the next talk when we look at the Psalms together.